Operation scored 3 outfits each.
Alone, Lieutenant Commander Geordi LaForge was drinking a Michelob Light.
His visor was a modified hairband, and he was telling a girl that she might as well take her top off. He could see through her clothes with his visor anyway. When he brought the bottle to his lips, she tipped it up and walked away, mumbling, "Bet you didn't see that coming." At the island in the kitchen, a pale white kid wearing a bald cap and a red Star Trek The Next Generation uniform stood by the blender, overseeing the contents being poured in. When the top went on the device, he pointed and said, "Engage." He tugged at the bottom of his tunic, turned, and nearly shouted, "You have the bridge, number one." It wasn't clear whom he was talking to. One of the Darth Vaders called for a girl dressed as Marge Simpson to grab him a beer.
"I thought you were driving," she said.
He grew still and made his voice deeper. "I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further." Several drinking games were going on. Loud music played, Green Day at the moment. Lines for both the home's bathrooms spilled down one hall. Desmond was rather relieved to see no other Agent Fox Mulders, though there was one Scully. Her outfit was pretty good. A black pantsuit and a white button-up shirt with a collar laid over the lapels of the jacket. She'd printed her ID on a computer. It even had her own picture on it next to the large blue FBI letters. The red wig was the right color. She was about 5'6", slender, with dark brown eyebrows and fair skin. Her eyes were a little large for her face. Desmond found that attractive. She was standing with a group of 5 people holding a red Solo cup she wasn't paying much attention to, when one of the Luke Skywalkers approached her. A Darth Vader was his wingman. The guy's voice was nasal, rehearsed.
"Excuse me, am I to understand that you're a female body inspector?"
Scully smiled but didn't laugh. "Nice try. Come back when you've got better material, Padawan." Skywalker glanced at Vader.
"The Force is strong with this one."
That did make Desmond laugh. Poor guy. The two faded back into the crowd, leaving Scully staring directly at Desmond. He had spent countless hours in bars, witnessed maybe 10,000 guys hit on girls. In that time, he had learned 2 things. 1, if you see a girl you're interested in, don't hesitate. The moment you make eye contact, just go over there. Waiting hurts the cause. And 2, pickup lines are useless. A woman is either interested or not. They pretty much know instantly. They don't pick a guy based on the pickup line. Confidence is the universal attractor, and nothing says confidence like not having a pickup line. He never broke eye contact as he walked over.
"Hi."
"Hi.
I'm Fox Mulder."
She extended her hand. It felt absolutely tiny in his.
"Dana Scully." Her face was stoic. Desmond thought it was a pretty good imitation of the character.
She was definitely game for the role play. "I know why you're here."
"Do you?"
"You've been sent to debunk my work."
"What can I say, Mulder? I'm a woman of science."
"So you don't want to believe?"
"With science, what I want is irrelevant. Proof of a hypothesis is all that matters."
She tucked a strand of red hair behind her ear. He could see her dark brown hair under the wig.
"What's your current case?" she asked.
He sighed theatrically. "Tough one. There have been reports of an aberrant human in the Palo Alto area."
"Aberrant?"
"An anomaly, Scully. A woman who doesn't conform to any of the known norms of the human species. Paranormal intelligence and attractiveness. Extreme wittiness. We could be looking at genetic engineering. Possible extraterrestrial involvement." She finally broke character, smiled and laughed quickly, then returned to a straight face.
"Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence."
"I've recently confirmed the evidence." One of her friends, who was dressed like Uma Thurman from Pulp Fiction, grabbed her by the arm.
"Hey, there you are. Let's go."
The girl was very drunk.
"Yeah, just a minute,"
Scully said quickly.
"No, come on. Paul and Ross have already left. Come on."
She was dragging her now. Scully turned.
"Sorry. Duty calls."
A coy smile spread across her lips.
"Good luck with your case."
She glanced back at him one last time before her friend dragged her out the front door. In the kitchen, Desmond waited for the blender to stop mixing up a fresh pitcher of margaritas, then asked the host, "Who's the girl dressed as Scully?" He concentrated on his pour.
Scully? That's, Peyton Shaw.
Desmond opened his eyes and stared at Peyton, who was still holding Hannah's head in her lap. A smile spread across his face. Hi, Scully. Peyton's eyes instantly locked onto his. To Desmond's surprise, he saw shock, then what he thought was fear. A sad, remorseful smile crossed her lips.
What?
How much do you remember? She asked.
We met in Palo Alto, at a Halloween party.
She nodded slowly but said nothing.
Did I say something wrong?
She shook her head.
Hey, he said, what happened between us?
Before she could answer, Avery shouted from the pilot's seat,
Look alive back there, and put your headsets on!
Desmond's eyes grew wide when he saw the scene beyond the helicopter's windshield. Chapter 64 Avery pulled back on the helicopter's stick, flying above the smoke that spread out beyond Mombasa. A minute later, Peyton got their first glimpse of the carnage. Mombasa was Kenya's second largest city and the largest port in East Africa. At the center of the sprawling metropolis lay Mombasa Island, which was connected by causeways to three peninsulas from the Kenyan mainland. Right now, those causeways were packed with cars and people trying to escape the island. From above, they looked like ants marching over a bridge, fleeing the chaos. The Changamwe oil refinery, which lay at the back of the island, just before one of the bridges to the mainland, was ablaze, belching smoke into the air. Its tanks and pipes would give the fire an almost endless source of fuel. The fires were not the only problem. A dozen large cargo ships lay scuttled at the mouth of the bay, their rectangular metal cargo containers spilled into the water, the mountain of steel forming an impassable barrier.
They've sealed the port, Avery called over the headsets. Could have been the Kenyans as an act of containment.
Or another nation, Desmond said. To protect themselves.
He peered out the window, his eyes narrowing.
They bombed the airport's runway, too.
Peyton stared in awe at the city. From their vantage point, she could see one of the hospitals. A crowd was massed outside, hundreds of people trying to get in. Bodies lay in the streets, dying, trampled. Mombasa was her worst nightmare, an uncontrolled outbreak in a major city. Millions of people at the mercy of a pathogen with no cure and no treatment. All of them left to suffer and die. Peyton had dedicated her life to ensuring this very scene never became a reality. She had flown to Kenya to stop this. Yet now it was happening. She had failed. They, Connor McLean, had beaten her. If this was happening in Mombasa, she wondered what Nairobi was like, what America was like. In that moment, she set aside her fears about her own safety and Hannah's. She needed a place to start, needed to know how long she'd been in captivity, how long the virus had been loose.
What day is it?
She asked.
Monday,
Avery replied. That came as a shock. Peyton had flown to Nairobi the previous Sunday, a full week ago.
What's the status of the outbreak in Kenya?
She asked urgently.
I don't know,
Avery said.
What do you mean you don't know?
Peyton didn't even try to hide her skepticism.
Again, we were under a comms blackout. Any information about the outbreak was tightly guarded. People on that ship have families, too. I've only heard rumors.
Such as? Peyton was almost certain she was lying, or at best, keeping information from them.
Such as there are 200,000 dead in Kenya from the Mandera strain. Another 500,000 around the world have died from the precursor flu virus.
Precursor. So what McLean had told her was true. The flu strain that Elliot had been tracking was the precursor for the Mandera virus. It mutated into the deadly hemorrhagic fever that had killed the two Americans, including Lucas Turner. Some part of her had hoped McLean was bluffing, posturing to scare her. She almost didn't want to know the answer to her next question.
How many are infected?
Avery was hesitant.
Hard to say. I've heard 3 billion, maybe more.
Peyton's head swam. She swallowed. For a long moment, she thought she might throw up, or even pass out. 3 billion people infected. It was an unimaginable catastrophe. If what happened in Mandera occurred around the world,
human civilization wouldn't recover for decades, possibly centuries. In fact, she had no idea what the world would look like after that. At the rate the virus was spreading, she wondered, would there be only a few million survivors? A few thousand? But Connor McLean had created a cure. Was he going to give it to his chosen few? Peyton had to find that cure for her own sake and the sake of so many others. McLean has a cure. He told me on the ship. It's true, Avery said. They informed everyone on board that it had been administered recently in our routine vaccinations. All employees at Sishium companies received it. She glanced back at Desmond. Including you. He only nodded and glanced out the window, staring at the horrific scene, a hint of guilt on his face. Avery moved the helicopter inland away from the city. It was obvious that landing in Mombasa would likely be a death sentence. The helicopter would be mobbed, rushed by people hoping to get out or hoping for help to arrive. And once on the ground, they would find no way out of the city and no help for Hannah within. Avery reached under the seat, unfolded a map, and studied it.
What are you doing? Peyton asked.
Avery didn't look up.
Trying to figure out where to go, Princess.
Don't call me Princess.
Desmond held a hand up to Peyton. Ladies, we're all on the same team here. Let's talk. What are you thinking, Avery?
I'm thinking we're screwed.
Okay, so nothing new there. What do we need? A sat phone and a plane, correct?
And a hospital,
Peyton said quickly. She glanced at Hannah, asleep, helpless, taking shallow breaths as she lay in the floor of the helicopter.
I won't let her die.
Desmond spoke before Avery could.
Right. So what, we fly along the coast, try to find a city still intact?
Danny Beach is close by,
Peyton said.
They've got a great hospital and an airstrip. Lots of other coastal towns along the way. Once we cross the border with Tanzania, there's Tanga and Dar es Salaam farther south, plus the Tanzanian islands off the coast.
They'll shoot us, Avery said flatly.
Who?
Peyton asked.
The Tanzanians. Think about it. You've got a raging outbreak to the north. Step one is to close your airspace, shoot anything flying in from Kenya. And the Kenyan coastal towns are no good either. They're probably in the same shape as Mombasa, and I'm sure Connor is enlisting search parties there too. The American government has no presence or assets in Danny Beach that I'm aware of. There's a CIA station in Dar es Salaam, and an embassy for that matter, but we'll never reach them.
So we go inland, Desmond said.
Nairobi?
Suicide, Avery said. If Mombasa looks like this, imagine Nairobi.
Then Connor will assume that's our only move.
I think...
What?
I think we're trapped.
We're not, Peyton said. She had an idea. It was a gamble, but it just might pay off. Desmond studied her.
I know where we can go, she said. It's inland in Kenya. It has an airstrip, sat phones, and a hospital. My guess is the outbreak is contained at this location, and McLean will never think to look for us there.
After Peyton told them her plan, Avery studied the map.
It's at the Hilo's max range. 50-50 odds we have enough fuel to get there. If it's a bust, we're stranded for sure.
Flight time?
Desmond asked.
It's about 350 miles away. 2 hours, roughly.
Peyton looked down at Hannah. She didn't know if the young woman had 2 hours, but she felt like her plan was their only hope. Chapter 65. Desmond sat against the back wall of the helicopter, side by side with Peyton. They glanced at each other for a moment, then stared forward, riding in silence. Out the window, the last rays of sunlight were receding behind the mountains in the distance. The helicopter rotor's rhythmic drone was almost hypnotic, and before long, Desmond felt Peyton's head fall on his shoulder. The woman was worn out. He tried not to move. He wanted her to get some rest. For him, sleep was elusive. Questions ran through his mind. What he had learned on the Kintaro Maru had shocked him. If what Connor had said was true, he was partially responsible for starting the outbreak. He wondered if somewhere buried in his memories was the key to stopping it, or if it was buried in the Labyrinth reality app he had found in Berlin, or both. He closed his eyes and concentrated, trying to remember his past. The morning after the Halloween party, Desmond stopped by XTV's accounting department. His investigative work had revealed that Peyton was a sophomore at Stanford, and that Andrea, an XTV intern who had graduated from Stanford in June, was a friend of hers. Desmond found Andrea in her cubicle, staring at her computer screen, twirling a strand of sandy brown hair around her index finger.
Hey, you know Peyton Shaw, right?
Uh-huh.
She seemed to be tabulating figures on the screen. Finally, she turned.
What's up?
He shrugged, trying to seem nonchalant.
Nothing, just think it'd be cool if you invited her to the company party on Thursday.
Andrea smiled.
Really? You do? You think it'd be cool?
Desmond sighed.
Andy.
Her tone was taunting now.
Somebody's got a crush.
Oh, please. What grade are you in?
I could ask you the same thing, lover boy.
Will you do it?
For a price.
Desmond stood there, dreading her next words. She handed him some papers. These are the timesheets for hourly employees and contractors. I have to type these in every week and verify them. I want a web form where they enter their hours and it automatically downloads to our payroll system. Desmond opened his mouth to respond, but Andrea had more.
And I want error checking and validation. No non-numeric characters, verification on values outside expected ranges, the whole nine. And it better work in Netscape and IE.
Is that all? Automate your entire internship?
It's a wicked world, Des. Even love has a price.
She eyed him dramatically.
And it don't come cheap.
You're a lunatic.
Email me the link for testing.
He finished the web form before lunch. The XTV party was a celebration of a new round of funding, a new release of their software, and half a dozen milestones they had hit. They were barreling closer to their vision of taking over television forever. Desmond found Peyton at a round table with Andrea. Two half-empty champagne glasses sat before them.
Ladies, he said as he reached them, can I get you a refill?
Andrea looked at him with a sadistic smile only a torturer would wear.
You waiting tables now, Desmond?
What can I say? Stock options don't buy groceries.
Peyton laughed. Andrea rolled her eyes and grabbed her champagne glass.
I'm just going to go smash this champagne glass and eat the sharpest pieces. You kids, try not to kill anyone with those puppy love eyes.
Desmond sat down as she stalked off to the bar.
She's very subtle, he said.
Very.
I think she may have a lot of pent-up aggression.
Bad breakup last semester.
And she sort of hates her internship. Peyton smiled.
Heard you helped her with that.
Ah, well. All in the line of duty.
Part of your case?
Yes, ma'am.
Any new leads?
Working on something now.
Promising?
He studied her.
Too early to tell.
I wouldn't be so sure.
She took another sip of the champagne.
You like working at XTV?
She said.
Yeah, I do.
Why?
I like solving problems. Going home every day knowing I made some progress on something. Waking up every morning with a new set of problems to solve.
What'd you do before?
Worked on an oil rig.
She smiled, about to laugh, and squinted at him.
You're serious, aren't you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
He figured he might as well be up front with her. No sense going down this road if it was a dead end. Better to get the deal breakers out on the table.
I didn't go to college. Just moved out here from Oklahoma.
He knew she was a biology major and wanted to become a doctor. Her pedigree was a little more sophisticated than an orphaned oil well driller who had recently killed a man.
Why?
The question caught him by surprise.
Why what?
What brought you out here?
Since he'd been in the valley, no one had actually asked him that.
The work.
He thought a moment.
The people. I wanted to meet people like me.
You want to meet some more of them?
Yeah, I do.
The coy smile returned to her lips.
Hold out your hand.
He extended his hand. She opened her handbag and drew out a pen, then scribbled an address on his palm.
What's this?
Another clue for your case. There's a house party in Menlo Park Saturday night, with lots of people like you. I think you'd like it.
Will you be there?
Yeah.
Then so will I.
The house party in Menlo Park was quite different from the raging Halloween party where Desmond had met Peyton. He was a little nervous walking up to the Mediterranean-style home, but that disappeared when Peyton opened the door and smiled at him. She wore a black dress, diamond earrings, and a light gray cardigan to ward off the chill in the November air. She had been right about the partygoers.
Desmond found the conversations incredibly interesting. It wasn't idle chat, no gossip, no talk of what was on TV. They discussed big issues, everything from technology to science to politics to world history. Most of the attendees were Stanford students like Peyton or recent graduates. About half had the next big idea for a startup that would change the world. Their certainty grew with each beer can opened, every bowl smoked. On the whole, it was an inside look at how founders thought about their startup ideas and shaped their vision. Some of the people there were just dreamers, big talkers. But he thought maybe some would actually start a company and succeed. He just had no idea which ones they were. Outside on the porch, he found Peyton standing alone. "Something wrong?" he asked. She turned, a smile forming on her slender face. "Only so much hyperbole I can stand in one night." He let out a laugh. "You're loving it, though, aren't you?" she said.
"I am. I knew you would."
He studied her a moment. "This is what you're after, isn't it?" she said. "Starting your own company or being part of a hit startup?"
"It's not the only thing I'm after."
They stared at each other.
"What about you, Peyton? What do you want?"
"Right now, all I want is to get out of here." Desmond stood there, watching her walk closer to him. "This is the point where any normal guy would offer to take me home, Desmond."
"I'm not exactly a normal guy."
"I know." She took his hand and walked off the porch, leading him.
"My truck is beyond scary. I saw you pull up in it."
She reached in her bag, tossed her keys in the air, and he caught them. "We'll take my car." In her dorm's parking lot, he leaned over and kissed her. Her hand moved to his face, pulling him closer. At the outer door, she swiped her card. They were kissing again, her walking backwards as they stumbled into her dorm room. Desmond saw everything in flashes as his shirt came up, and they resumed kissing before her shirt came off. Biology and chemistry books littered the floor. She tossed an IBM ThinkPad off her bed. He winced, hoping it would survive the fall. The place smelled of candles and something sweet he couldn't place. He glanced back at the door.
"Your roommate is home in Seattle."
That night was like the first computer program he ever wrote. A series of runtime errors followed by a quick compilation. He was thankful that it was too dark for her to see his scars. In the morning, however, sunlight blazed through the window. He saw her eyeing the burns on his feet and legs, the knife wounds on his chest and abdomen, and a dozen other small scars. She said nothing, only went to the bathroom, brushed her teeth, washed her face, and threw on some clothes. She was a lot less chatty than last night. Desmond wondered if she regretted it, wondered if he should say something. "I'm late," she said. He sat up. "I have lunch with my mom and sister every Sunday."
"I..."
"Relax, cowboy. Just pull the door shut when you leave." She handed him a small slip of paper.
"What's this?"
"The last part of the case you're working." He unfolded it. It was her phone number. Chapter 66. After the night he spent with Peyton, Desmond's life settled into a pattern. He worked his heart out at XTV, saw Peyton in his off hours, and read when he wasn't spending time with her. He found a new library and began requesting books on finance and investing. He read Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor and Security Analysis and everything he could find on the subject. His inheritance, roughly $320,000, was still hidden in a sack in the Airstream trailer. His only real expenses had been the trailer, the suit, and the legal costs of settling Orville's estate. He became obsessed with how to invest the remaining money. At lunch one day in the company break room, a solution of sorts presented itself. He overheard two of the company's early employees, a programmer and a database developer, discussing skyrocketing home prices and the outrageous cost of daycare. Their startup salaries were meager, and their wives were pressuring them to bail and get a job at a larger company like Oracle or Sun. Desmond took a seat at the table.
"Gentlemen, I think I might have a solution for you."
That night, he told Peyton his plan.
"It's a bad idea, Des.
Think about it.
With the money I have, I could buy a huge chunk of options. They get the cash they need, I get more options. It's a great idea, he insisted.
Okay, it's a good idea.
Exactly.
But it's the wrong approach.
What do you mean?
You need to diversify.
No, XTV will be huge. I need to concentrate.
And if XTV goes under?
It won't.
You don't know that.
He sat there, wondering why she wasn't more supportive.
Be prepared.
What?
The Boy Scout motto. Surely that was big in Oklahoma. He exhaled heavily through his nose.
My uncle wasn't keen on extracurriculars.
She looked away, sensing he didn't want to talk about it. I like the idea, Desmond. I just think if you buy options, you should do it in other companies. You already own plenty of XTV options. I got a bunch of friends who work at other startups. I can ask around, see if anyone is interested.
The more he thought about it, the more he thought she was right. And he liked that she hadn't given up on her point. He needed someone like that in his life.
In the following weeks, Desmond met with dozens of startup employees in coffee shops and at their homes. His lawyer read their employment contracts to ensure that they were free to sell their options and drew up a purchase contract that Desmond used to buy stakes in a few companies within a month. Those companies were happy to cooperate. They wanted to keep their employees happy, and the cash from Desmond allowed those employees to maintain their lifestyle while staying at the company. A few months later, all of his money was invested. He owned stock options in 14 companies. He was more selective after that. He used every penny left over from his salary to buy options in the most attractive companies. And he insisted Wallace send him a bill for the legal work, which he paid promptly. Every morning, Desmond checked the website for the Norman Transcript, the local paper for Norman, Oklahoma, and the closest thing to a local paper for the Slaughterville area. He skipped the news, focused on the classifieds. As promised, the local lawyer ran a notification opening the estate of Orville Thompson Hughes. A few months later, a story ran into the local news section entitled, Library System Receives Surprise Donation. Yesterday, the Pioneer Library System was pleasantly surprised to receive a donation for $32,000 in the name of Agnes Andrews, a longtime librarian who passed away 10 years ago. Even more unexpected was the source of the donation, Orville T. Hughes, a recently deceased oil rig worker. Upon receiving the sum, the library found that Mr. Hughes had no library card, and as best as anyone could remember, had never even visited one of the libraries in the system. Even more confounding, relatives of the deceased Ms. Andrews weren't aware that the woman had ever known Mr. Hughes. It's a mystery, Edward Yancey, the library system administrator, said. But we sure aren't trying to solve it. Lord knows we could use the money, and we're just thankful to have it.
Desmond smiled. He had expected the small farm to bring more, but it was done, and the money had made its way to the right place. Agnes and the library system had been there for him during one of the darkest chapters of his life. He hoped the money would help ensure that it was there for the next person who needed it.
One Wednesday morning, Desmond arrived at work to find a group of XTV employees crowded around the front door. Nearly everyone was either on their cell phones or whispering to each other. Desmond assumed there'd been a fire, or an accident, or a gas leak. It was none of those things. The company had run out of money. The landlord had finally locked them out of their headquarters. The venture capitalists who had funded the venture were in control, and they were selling everything that wasn't nailed down. The servers, desks, routers. Even the XTV sweatshirts were donated to a local homeless shelter for a tax write-off. Desmond's options were worthless. He couldn't even get inside to his desk to get his personal effects. Things changed after that. Without a job, a purpose, Desmond felt lost. He watched three more of the companies he held options for fold. Each one was like a punch in the gut.
It's not over yet, Des, Peyton told him.
He and Peyton began spending more time together. He helped her cram for her exams, and she helped him sort through a few job opportunities. In May, when the school year was over, he helped her move from her dorm room into a one-bedroom apartment in Menlo Park. Most undergrads at Stanford lived on campus and moved back home for the summer or got a short-term rental. Peyton signed a 1-year lease. She got a summer internship at SRI doing genetics research, and she seemed to really enjoy it. That made him happy.
By July, he was sleeping at her place most of the time. It was comfortable. He liked being around her, but he felt a deep guilt about it. There was something wrong with him, and he couldn't figure out how to tell her. Peyton had never asked him about the scars, or his past, for that matter, and she rarely asked him for anything. That changed one Saturday night. "Will you do something for me?"
"Anything," he answered.
"My mom and my sister's husband are coming for lunch tomorrow. Join us." He said nothing. "They won't bite, Des." Her mother's name was Lynn. She had an MD and a PhD, and was the daughter of a German father and a Chinese mother. He could see a strong resemblance between the two women. Peyton was Lynn Shaw's younger daughter, Madison the older. Lynn was a researcher at Stanford and an adjunct professor. Madison worked for a non-profit concerned with the preservation of wildlife. Desmond made a mental note not to mention how many deer, wild hogs, turkeys, and elk he had killed. Madison's husband, Derek, was an investment banker in San Francisco. He had an MBA from Wharton, a place Desmond had never heard of, and seemed to take himself rather seriously. He was also the principal interrogator at lunch. Desmond figured he was just being protective, trying to play the role of father figure, since Peyton's own father had passed away.
"What's your alma mater, Desmond?"
Derek asked.
"Noble High School."
"You didn't go to college?"
"Didn't need to."
Derek didn't like that answer, though Peyton smiled. The man pressed on.
"What do your parents do?"
"They owned a ranch in Australia."
His eyes lit up.
"Before they died."
"You don't sound Australian, dear,"
Lynn said.
"I moved here when I was young."
"To the Bay Area?"
"Oklahoma."
"Oklahoma."
Derek turned the word over in his mouth like a bone he'd unexpectedly found in his soup. Back at Peyton's apartment, Desmond stood in the kitchen.
"They hated me."
"They loved you."
"I'm a country boy, but I'm not stupid. They don't think I'm good enough for you, Peyton."
"I'll be the judge of that."
"And so will your family."
"Maybe. But they don't make my decisions for me. I do.
And I don't care if you don't have a college degree."
Before he could speak, she added, "All I want is you, Desmond." Desmond opened his eyes. The helicopter was vibrating even more. Avery was pushing it to its limits. Peyton's head still rested on his shoulder. She was out cold. He desperately wanted to wake her, to ask what had happened to them, how they had lost what he felt all those years ago. Somehow he knew he was nearing the end of the memories he could access, like a faraway signpost he could just make out through a fog. He wondered if the programmer Byron had been right on the ship. Had Desmond made these memories of his youth and his years with Peyton available via cues? The cold in Berlin, the cell in the barn, the picture of Orville, seeing Peyton again, touching her skin, each seemed to have opened the door to a chapter of his past. But he sensed that his most crucial memories would not be so easily retrieved, especially the location of rendition. That secret was the reason for his amnesia in the first place, the reason he had built this labyrinth.
That's it. The Labyrinth Reality app. It's the key.
His breadcrumbs had led him to the app. He was now more certain than ever that it would unlock the rest of his past. He needed to get a phone and re-download the app. What he didn't know was whether he was ready to know exactly what he had done and exactly what kind of man he was. There was one memory left that he could reach now, and he closed his eyes, willing it to come. Chapter 67. After what Desmond considered to be a disastrous lunch with Peyton's family, he didn't see them much. He interviewed at a half dozen startups, but he found himself with a new problem. He was gun-shy, afraid to commit. What if it was another XTV? He didn't want to make the same mistake. Another startup he had options in failed that week. He would be out of money for the trailer park rent within a month. He needed to take one of the job offers soon. Christmas was a week away. He was terrified Peyton was going to ask him to come home with her. She didn't. She seemed to instinctively know his boundaries. "Just so you don't get carried away and buy me an island or something for Christmas, let's set some ground rules," she said.
"All right.
We can spend $10 on each other."
"Okay."
"And the gift has to reveal something about each of us." That confused him. I want to know something about you, Desmond. It has to reveal something about your past, an experience that shaped you somehow, understand? He did, and he had no idea what to give her. He obsessed in the weeks leading up to Christmas. He also turned over the job offers. Yet another company he had options in failed. His stack of lottery tickets was slowly migrating to the trash can, as fate took the numbered balls out of the hopper and more startups closed. He drove his truck to Portola Redwood State Park one night, hiked in, and cut down a small redwood, then cut the limbs away. He brought it home, whittled away at it for a few days, checked the local events calendar, and found what he needed. 2 days before Christmas, in her apartment, Peyton set her gift on the coffee table. It was wrapped immaculately. Desmond hadn't wrapped his. He felt nervous instantly. He tore off the wrapping paper, revealing a cardboard box. He opened it and found a map lying on top of another box, also wrapped. He picked up the map and unfolded it. Cities were highlighted in yellow. London, England. Heidelberg, Germany. Hong Kong. Two small towns in Scotland, one in Ireland, and another in southern China. "Yellow is where my family's from," Peyton said. "Parents, grandparents." Desmond studied the rest of the map. There were 2 dozen green marks. "Green is all the places I'd like to go with you, Des, someday." He swallowed and fell silent, staring at it like he was reading a judge's death sentence. She had plans for them, and she'd been thinking about them for a while. "Open the next one," she said, excited, oblivious to his anxiety. The next box contained a miniature figure of a mermaid on a small spring. The base was emblazoned with the words, "Palo Alto." "Closest I could get," she said. She stared at him expectantly. "Any guesses?"
"Come on.
Your favorite movie is The Little Mermaid?" She socked him hard in the shoulder.
"No, I was on the swim team in high school."
"Oh, of course. How could I have missed it? It's so obvious now." Beneath the mermaid was a third box. She didn't encourage him to open this one. In fact, she seemed nervous about it, as if she had changed her mind. She looked away as Desmond tore the wrapping paper. The object inside the last box was small. His fingers wrapped around it, lifted it out. It was a glass object, heart-shaped, red.
"I love you, Des," she said.
He tucked it in his pocket, leaned forward and kissed her. "I've never felt this way about anyone before," he said. She smiled quickly, clearly disappointed, but rolled her eyes, trying to seem playful, unbothered.
"Jeez, what are you, a lawyer now?"
"I mean it." He held up the glass heart. "But I'm not like you. My heart isn't like yours."
"There's nothing wrong with your heart, Desmond." She stared at him.
With increasing frequency, he had wondered if that was true.
"Okay, what did you get me?" she asked, eager.
He dug into his backpack, drew the item out, and handed it to her. She held the carved wooden object, examining it.
"It's the Eiffel Tower? You want to go to France?"
"No." He shook his head, frustrated. "I mean, maybe, I would. But it's an oil rig."
"Oh." She studied it again. "I thought they were shaped like hammers, you know, going up and down into the ground."
"You're talking about the walking beam and Horsehead. This is the rig, the thing that drills the well."
She nodded.
"So, it's what I used to work on."
"Oh."
"In Oklahoma. It's part of where I got the scars."
Her eyes widened. She held the carved wooden object with more care. "Thank you, Des. I love it. It's perfect."
"It's not all."
Her face lit up.
"The second part wouldn't fit in a box." They loaded up in his truck, which she had gradually become less scared of, and drove up the 101 to 92 and over to Half Moon Bay. They could see the roaring bonfire before they reached the beach. Desmond wrapped his coat around her, took a bundle from the back seat, and led her in silence toward the blaze. He laid the thick blanket out on the sand and unscrewed the cap on the cheap wine, and they sat together, the fire warming them, her in front of him, facing it, tipping the bottle up every few minutes. Desmond estimated there were only about 50 people there, mostly around their age, couples and some groups, talking, drinking, and laughing.
"You gonna have some?"
she asked.
No.
Why not?
A promise I made.
To whom?
Myself.
She leaned against him, and they both stared at the fire and the water beyond. It was unseasonably warm for December, but there was still a chill in the air. Desmond wrapped the blanket around them just in case she was cold.
You cheated, Peyton said.
How?
$10 was the limit.
Then I'm under.
She turned, looked at him.
The tree was free. So was the labor to carve it. The wine was $6.68. I figured $3 in gas round trip is more than enough.
You should have been an accountant.
The crowd thinned out, but the fire burned on. A few couples and stragglers remained, as well as the two park workers managing the event. The bottle was half empty, and Desmond could tell she was nursing it, wouldn't finish it. She twisted around, kissed him on the mouth, a hungry, deep kiss that tasted of wine. He stood, pulled her up, and led her away, past the dunes and the tall grass where the sand ended, to a depression where the moonlight was dim. They spread the blanket out again and lowered her onto it. When he kissed her, she closed her eyes and let him lead. On the way home, she asked, what did it mean?
What?
The fire. Each gift had to reveal something about its bearer. The image of the heart and her words, I love you, flashed in his mind.
The fire's how my family died, in Australia.
He told her how it happened then, the words spilling like water over a broken levee. He told her about Charlotte, how he had come to America, about living with Orville, Agnes's death, even Orville's passing, and what happened after, when Dale Epley showed up at the house. He never could have imagined the release it brought. Telling someone, telling the person he trusted most in the world, having no more secrets with her, it was like a weight was lifted, a weight he hadn't even known he was carrying. He felt freer and safer than he ever had before. At her apartment, they made love again, slower this time. They lay in bed after that, staring at the ceiling, listening to an MP3 playlist on her laptop with songs by Green Day, Weezer, Stone Temple Pilots, Smashing Pumpkins, R.E.M., and Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I'm so sorry, Des, I had no idea.
They got me here. That's all that matters.
Come with me tomorrow.
His first meeting with her family had been enough for a lifetime, but a part of him wanted to go. Despite that, he told her he couldn't, that he wanted to be alone. It was a lie. He desperately wanted to be with her. He and Orville had never celebrated Christmas or birthdays. He tried to imagine himself at her mother's house, sitting at the dinner table or by the fire with her at his side. He couldn't. It wasn't just because he was nervous about the prospect. It was because of something else, a problem far larger than he imagined. He spent Christmas in the Airstream trailer, alone, a can of beans heating on the stove, an electric heater warming the tiny bedroom. He read library books and traded emails with Peyton. The tone in his replies never matched the warmth of her notes. That bothered him. He wrote and rewrote each message, like they were Egyptian hieroglyphics he couldn't seem to arrange just right. Email wasn't his only problem. Money was still tight. His meals consisted of beans and canned meat, just like the early days when he'd gone to live with Orville. He couldn't help thinking about the grocer who had helped him ration his limited funds and made sure he had enough to eat. Knowing now that Orville had stashed a veritable mountain of cash in the safe inside the old truck out back actually brought a smile to Desmond's face. The old roughneck was miserly and mean as a snake, but in the end, it had a sort of logic to him. Desmond actually missed the man. He also worried that he had squandered every bit of money Orville had so carefully saved all those years. After Christmas, four more of the companies he owned options in folded. They hadn't wanted to ruin their employees' holiday, but they also didn't want to start the year wasting any more investor money. Each email was a punch in the gut. He felt the prospect of financial security slipping away. It focused him. He dug in, tried to figure out why some companies survived and others went up in smoke. It seemed almost arbitrary. He spent hours thinking about it, reading articles, studying books on business history. The week after Christmas,
Peyton insisted that he stop eating canned meat and beans for every meal.
You're going to get some weird digestive disease and die, Des.
The obituary will say, Desmond Hughes, talented programmer and lover of books, died of pork and beans in an RV park outside Palo Alto.
He laughed and relented, letting her cook at least half his meals. They were a lot tastier.
He also began staying at her place without exception. Another one of her theories was that the electric heater was going to cut out in the night, and he would freeze to death in the airstream. Neither of them really believed it, but in the days before New Year's Eve in 1997, they spent every night together, and neither of them was cold.
Chapter 68.
In the helicopter, Desmond watched the sun set over the mountains. Peyton was still asleep beside him, her head on his shoulder. There were so many things he wanted to ask her. Why they hadn't ended up together. How they had lost what he had felt that night in Half Moon Bay. What had happened to them? When Peyton stirred, he leaned forward and caught her eye. She seemed to sense the change in him.
What did you remember?
Us. She looked away, down at Hannah, who lay still, her breathing shallow. Desmond gripped her arm. I remember the Halloween party, and XTV, and that mermaid ornament, and the glass heart, and Half Moon Bay, and that badly carved oil rig I gave you. He smiled, but she didn't return it. To his surprise, she looked away. Gently, he placed a hand on her chin, turned her to look into his eyes. I remember us being happy, but not what came after. Tell me, please.
No.
What if it's related to what's happening right now?
It's not.
Did I hurt you? Peyton closed her eyes.
It wasn't like that.
What do you mean?
What happened hurt both of us.
What does that mean? He was about to ask when Avery glanced back from the pilot seat and pointed to the headset. To Desmond's dismay, Peyton pulled her headset on quickly. He reluctantly followed suit.
Let's talk about what happens when we land, Avery said.
Peyton methodically laid out her plan. Avery made a few suggestions. Demands, really. But they were all in agreement about the course of action. With that out of the way, Desmond focused on Avery, asking the first question among so many he wanted answered.
The people on the ship in the hospital ward, what were they infected with?
I don't know. I was part of the IT group.
She glanced back at him, a curious, unreadable expression on her face.
What?
It was your experiment, Des.
I did that to them?
Desmond felt sick at the idea.
It was part of the rendition project.
What is rendition?
I don't know.
Peyton spoke up.
What do you know, Avery? Why did you rescue us?
I wasn't aware I needed a formal invitation to rescue you.
They started snapping at each other then, voices escalating.
Desmond waited for an opening that never came. With forced calm in his voice, he interrupted.
Let's just back up here, okay?
A pause.
Look, if we keep fighting each other, we have no chance of stopping what's happening.
He let another few seconds pass, hoping everyone's nerves would settle. Then he suggested that each of them share what they knew and see if the pieces fit together somehow. Taking their silence as agreement, he went first. The two women sat quietly while Desmond recounted his story, beginning with how he had woken up in a hotel room in Berlin with a dead man on his floor, a security employee with Rapture Therapeutics, how he'd had no memories and no idea what had happened to him. How his only clue had been a cryptic code, a Caesar cipher that when decoded read, warn her, and listed Peyton's phone number. Was the warning about the pandemic or warning me not to go to Kenya?
I've thought about that. I think the warning was meant to keep you from going to Kenya. I think I knew they would abduct you, that you were personally connected to this somehow. On the ship, did they ask you personal questions, not related to the outbreak?
Peyton thought for a moment.
Connor asked me when was the last time I spoke with my father and brother.
Why is that important?
Avery asked.
They're both dead.
Avery glanced back at her, surprised. Desmond turned the information over in his mind. There was definitely a larger picture here, a connection he couldn't quite make.
Connor also asked about my mother. She's a genetics researcher at Stanford.
Peyton paused.
They wanted my CDC password. They drugged me. I think they got it.
Peyton recounted the rest of her time on the ship, being thorough, which Desmond appreciated. When she was done, he continued his story, describing how the police had appeared at his door just as he had called Peyton. How he had spent the next few days evading Berlin's security forces while decrypting messages he believed he had left for himself. How the codes had led him to a reporter for Der Spiegel, who had agreed to meet Desmond at a cafe on Unter den Linden. The reporter said I was an informant. I had told him that I was going to provide proof that would expose a network of corporations and scientists working on the largest experiment since the Manhattan Project. He said the project was called the Looking Glass, and that I had told him it would change humanity forever. Makes sense, Avery said. How? He told me you were planning a major move to try to stop the completion of the Looking Glass. Desmond studied her, wondering if she was telling him the truth. Was she really his ally and confidant? He was about to question her, but Peyton asked, What happened to the reporter? Connor's men took his fiancée hostage to get to me, Desmond said. It worked. They interrupted our meeting and captured me shortly after. I think it's safe to assume the reporter's out of play.
What is the Looking Glass? Peyton asked.
I don't know. He didn't either. Desmond looked at Avery. Do you know? She glanced back at him.
No.
I never found out.
Desmond sensed she was holding back. Was it because Peyton was there? Or was there another reason?
Did I know what it was? Desmond asked.
Definitely, Avery replied. In fact, I believe your work was essential to completing the Looking Glass. Your piece was the last component they needed.
Connor suggested as much when he questioned me on the ship, Desmond said.
Both he and the reporter told me that there were three components: Rook, Rendition, and Rapture.
Connor said I had been in charge of Rendition, but I have no memory of it.
He paused.
I've seen all of those names, though. Their company's my investment firm, Icarus Capital, funded.
I think another one of your investments may be involved, too, Peyton said. The first cases of the outbreak in Mandera were Americans. Two men who had recently graduated from college. They were in Kenya to launch a non-profit startup called CityForge. Icarus Capital funded them. In fact, the two young men had dinner with you. They said it was very eye-opening.
How so?
They were impressed, described you as larger than life.
Desmond saw a curious smile form on Avery's face, but she said nothing.
Peyton continued unaware. They said you were into some major next-generation projects, and that you believed humanity was on the cusp of extinction.
Why?
The absence of space junk.
Space junk? As in?
Interstellar probes. Relics from alien civilizations before us, from around the universe. They said you told them the moon should be an interstellar junkyard, covered with crashed probes and satellites. Yet we found nothing.
I don't understand, Desmond said.
They didn't either. Neither do I.
Desmond leaned forward, silently asking Avery if she knew. Hey, space junk isn't really my department, she said, eliciting a quiet laugh from Desmond and an annoyed expression from Peyton. So what is your department, Avery? Desmond asked. How do we know each other?
Avery hesitated. Desmond got the impression she was asking him whether it was okay for her to answer in front of Peyton.
We're laying all our cards on the table here, he said.
Avery nodded.
Okay.
Chapter 69. Avery began her story with some background. She had been raised in North Carolina and attended college there, majoring in computer science and minoring in two foreign languages, German and Chinese. During her senior year, she was invited to interview with a new venture capital firm called Rubicon Ventures. It was located just off I-40 in an older low-rise building in Research Triangle Park. The office was small, the decorations Spartan, most of the walls bare. Her first impression was of a boiler room operation set up overnight, not an established company. She pegged it as a fledgling venture destined to fold, and she had already decided to pass on the offer when the young woman at the reception desk showed her into a conference room. A middle-aged man with salt-and-pepper hair sat at the table, a closed folder in front of him. He introduced himself as David Ward and said, Don't mind the digs. We put all of our money into our work. To Avery's surprise, he asked no questions. He seemed to already know everything about her. He told her that the unique combination of skills, languages and computer science, would be invaluable to their work. He added that her winning record on UNC's tennis team was also a plus. That made her curious. Just curious enough to ask what sort of work she'd be doing. "Due diligence," he replied. She'd never heard the phrase, which he quickly defined. She'd be researching the startup companies Rubicon Ventures was considering investing in. He said they were high-tech companies with novel products, capable of changing the world. "You'd be traveling a lot, meeting with founders and executives to hear their pitches and gather information." It sounded utterly boring to her. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do after college, but she now knew it wasn't due diligence. As if reading her mind, David said, "You wouldn't be doing it because you like the work." "Why would I be doing it? For the money." That got her attention. Lately, she'd been doing a lot of things she didn't want to do for the money. He pushed a paper across the table. It was face down. She picked it up, read the job offer. A very strict non-disclosure, a non-compete, and a sum that raised her eyebrows. "If you decide this isn't for you, Avery, you can quit at any time." She'd grown up on a farm in North Carolina, a farm her family had lost to the bank 3 years before. Her father had always told her not to look a gift horse in the mouth. She was certain that the job offer she was staring at was exactly that, a gift horse. It was too much money, for work she wasn't really qualified to do. Something was wrong here. Despite her father's advice, she looked up, and with three words, she looked the gift horse in the mouth. "What's the catch?" Her host broke into a smile. "Very good, Miss Price. You've just passed our job interview."
"How's that?"
"In a word, guts. You've got guts." He focused on the pages in the folder. "You see, we do our due diligence, too. We know you're an only child, that your mother died in a car accident about 4 years ago, right after you went to college. We know that your father has late-stage Alzheimer's, that his care is not cheap, that you've been paying for it any way you can. You teach tennis. You work at a rundown ice cream parlor called," he peeked at the open folder, "The Yogurt Pump on Franklin Street. And though you're a straight-A student, you absolutely hate computer science. You chose the major for one reason only. Money. You figure you can get a good job after college, earn enough to take care of your father, and one day just maybe live your life, which in your mind would involve a lot of traveling and doing something outside, something very exciting." She stared at him, unsure what to say. Every word he'd said was true, but she couldn't imagine how he knew. "One of the companies we're interested in is called Rapture Therapeutics. They've developed what may just be a cure for Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative disorders." He slipped another page across the desk, a research brief on Rapture's latest breakthrough. "Does that interest you?" She read while he waited, only half understanding the science. "So," he said, "what's your answer, Avery? I need to know right now. There's one position. You're the first in line, but not the last."
"You already know my answer," she said.
"Welcome aboard, then." She spent a year after that researching the companies Rubicon was interested in, and as the months went by, a sneaking suspicion grew in her mind. At home, she began to keep separate files from the ones she turned in. She thought about her theory during every waking hour, while visiting her father at the care facility, at the gym, during flights, and in the countless hotel rooms that all ran together. In every meeting, at every company she visited, she began looking for evidence, any clue that might confirm her suspicions, or confirm that she had officially gone crazy. One morning, she walked into David's office, closed the door, and prepared to tell him what she thought. In her mind, she had imagined how he might react, laughing out loud, telling her to take a day off, telling her to stop watching so much TV. She said the line she'd rehearsed a dozen times. "I think there's something going on at the companies you've asked me to research."
"Like what?" His voice was even.
"I think they're fronts."
He still betrayed no emotion, no surprise, not even interest.
"Fronts for what?"
She swallowed.
"Terrorism."
He focused on his computer, began typing, acting as if she had told him their lunch meeting was canceled.
That's a very serious allegation.
I'm aware of that, she said, unwavering. I'm going to a meeting in Virginia tomorrow. I'll be driving up. I'd like you to come with me. Are you free?
Avery stood there, confused. It was as if he hadn't heard a word she'd said.
Yeah, I'm free. Did you hear what I just said?
I did. Let's meet here at 9. I'm sorry, Avery, I've got to run.
The next morning, they got on Highway 1 North, and I-85. At Petersburg, they took I-95 North. To Avery's surprise, they passed right through Richmond. After the exits for Fredericksburg, David turned off and drove through the country. He parked in front of a large colonial-era home with a crushed stone driveway. Inside, he ushered her into a wood-paneled library, where several cork boards were covered with names and colored strings. She knew the names. Corporations. There were photos of the company's officers and investors. Desmond Hughes, Connor McLean. They were all connected. These were the companies she'd been investigating. She walked up to the montage, her mouth open. It was true. Her theory.
Congratulations, Avery. Rubicon has a lot of agents. You figured it out faster than anyone else.
She felt a moment of pride as she studied the photos and logos.
What is this?
A new kind of terrorism. These people aren't religious idealists. They're not zealots, foaming at the mouth, waving AK-47s in the air. They're scientists, technologists, rational people, extremely intelligent, working in the shadows, diligently, planning.
Planning what?
We don't know. It's big, Avery. Changed the world forever big. A device called the Looking Glass. The companies you've been investigating are creating the pieces. Pieces that will be assembled at a later date.
Like the Manhattan Project.
Exactly.
Who are they?
Technically, they're the modern incarnation of an ancient organization called the Order of Sishim.
David walked to the bookshelf, took down a folder, and handed it to her.
We know the organization was founded 2,300 years ago in the Greek city of Sishim by a philosopher named Zeno. History books cite him as Zeno Sishim. People came from all over the civilized world to debate with him. Those conversations grew into something more. A movement. That's what they were back then. A group of philosophers. Thinkers.
What were they thinking about?
The meaning of the universe. The purpose of humanity. Why we exist.
Pretty deep stuff for 2,000 years ago.
They were ahead of their time. They applied themselves to three disciplines. Truth, ethics, and physics. And they were persecuted for their beliefs. They watched as polytheism, then monotheism, swept the world. They went underground, stayed there, waited for the world to catch up. It never did. Apparently, they're tired of waiting. They're going to do something about it.
The Looking Glass.
That's right.
And what is the Looking Glass?
That's what we're trying to